Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Criticism of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's handling of the war in Iraq is growing from a grumble to a roar, and it's coming from the Republican Party. Former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott is the latest GOP stalwart to call for a changing of the guard in the Pentagon. Bill Kristol, editor of the conservative magazine The Weekly Standard, also issued a sharp rebuke to Rumsfeld this week. He spoke to Steve Inskeep of NPR's Morning Edition today.
I just think he's been so consistently and stubbornly wrong on how to handle post-invasion Iraq. I just think I'm a strong supporter of Bush's foreign policy. I want it to work, and I don't think Rumsfeld is the Secretary of Defense who can best help it work.
So what's going on? Joining us to talk about Rumsfeld's future and the waging of war in Iraq is John Diamond, national security correspondent for USA Today. Welcome, John.
Good to be here.
And we're also joined by Ken Allard, former Army colonel and adjunct professor at Georgetown University. He joins us from his home in Alabama. Colonel, welcome.
Robin, good to be with you again.
And I know you both know each other.
Yes,
very
indeed.
Well.
Yes, I understand, John, you've learned a little bit from Mr. Allard along the way. But, John, I want to start with you first. Let's review. In the past week, we've heard from Republican Senators Trent Lott, John McCain, Chuck Hagel, as well as General Norman Schwarzkopf, all criticizing Donald Rumsfeld and either calling for a new Secretary of State or expressing no confidence in the current one. John, why now?
Well, I think that in the post-election environment, it's a bit safer for a Republican or a conservative to call for the replacement of a senior cabinet officer. You're no longer going to be seen as damaging the president's reelection bid. That whole issue is now by the boards. It's a done deal. And I think that what you're seeing, especially the quote from Bill Kristol just now, is a concern on the Republican side that the president get his policy right. And it's not so much a philosophical argument, rift or split within the party. It's the idea of we are in Iraq. We have a tough job to do. Let's get that job done right. And I think that there's a growing feeling that Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld is sort of wedded to his own statements over time.
But you know, Colonel Allard, I want to bring you in. Some are seeing Bill Kristol and other neoconservatives' comments as being a little disingenuous, given that there were people who were concerned about troop strength going into the war. And, you know, some are saying the neocons are making Rumsfeld a scapegoat for a policy that they backed.
Robin, if I answer that honestly, I'm going to sound very immodest to you, because you remember we've had this same conversation before.
That's right.
I would just simply tell you that, and I think John Diamond is absolutely right about the politics of this, but there's one other aspect to it, and that very simply as to why now. I think the chickens are simply coming home to roost. Many of the things that have been said by a number of critics for a number of months were very much forward thinking. If you didn't do something about things like armor, if you didn't do something about things like manpower, you were going to be running into difficulty. Well, guess what? That's exactly where we were headed, and that is exactly where we are right now.
And we come at a time with there are reports out today, John Diamond, that the Army National Guard says it needs $20 billion for new gear and that their recruitment is down. Your thoughts on how all of that factors in?
Well, one of the things that I think remarkable about this whole situation is how not new the issue of armor is. It's been around for almost 2 years now. And, you have the National Guard making its announcement about $20 billion. This is a reflection, of course, of the kind of meat grinder aspect of the insurgency, especially for equipment, just getting blown up and shot up and overused. I think that the miles, I saw some numbers on the mileage of tanks and Bradley armored vehicles, and Ken, this would be your department, you'd know all about this, but something on the order of 3 to 4 times
yep.
what their usual annual mileage would be. They're burning these machines into the ground. But Susan Collins, Senator, Republican from Maine, a rather moderate senator, member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, points out in a letter she is sending to Secretary Rumsfeld that the issue of armor, the shortage of armor, and the urgent need to up-armor the Humvees, among other things, came up at a March 2, 2003 Senate Armed Services Committee. This thing's been around for months, and the question is why is it taking so long for the Pentagon to deal with it?
Well, Colonel Allard, we also have a terrible story today. An Army specialist in Philadelphia allegedly had a friend shoot him in the leg so that he wouldn't have to go back to war and be redeployed. It seems as if from every aspect there's pressure upon President Bush to respond somehow. And I'm wondering, do you think he will? He said he's going to stand by Mr. Rumsfeld. And do you think if he does, it can affect change?
Robin, look, something here has got to give. Either the positions, the personalities, or the policies have got to change. The simple fact of life is that, again, so much of this was so predictable. As you pointed out, I live now in a small town in rural Alabama, and when the National Guard, when the reserves get called up, that literally affects every community in this state because they are somebody's father, somebody's husband, somebody's sheriff, somebody's teacher. And you simply have got to come to grips with the fact that we simply do not have enough people in uniform today. And you've got to do something about that. And by the way, that is not the same thing as saying, yeah, we need to resume the draft. That is simply a way of saying we have got to think creatively about how we attract more people in uniform and where we put them.
And part of the problem, John Diamond, is that Donald Rumsfeld has been resisting that notion. He's been a part of streamlining the military.
He has been, and there's nothing streamlined about the Iraq operation. It is a consumer of people and resources. I think it's really notable to point out that on the one hand, we have an operation in Iraq that has been criticized repeatedly for being too small in the number of troops, and yet that force, which many people think is too small, cannot be adequately equipped. So, I mean, what if the force were the right size, if it were 300,000? We'd be way short of armored Humvees then. So it seems like there really is a gap between what the American ground forces can do and what they're being asked to do right now.
And, John Diamond, you are there in Washington, D.C. What are you hearing? Do you think that there's going to be response to these calls?
Well, there is increasing talk. It's not rising to the level of volume of the criticism of Rumsfeld himself, but there's increasing talk about are there ways to make the Army itself larger, the all-volunteer Army? Are there ways to look at some of the real high-dollar defense programs like the
F-22
fighter?
But in the seconds we have, is there a move to replace Donald Rumsfeld?
That has to happen from the White House, and I'm not seeing any evidence of it yet.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both for weighing in. Obviously, this is a story we think is going to be the subject of many a talk show over the weekend. So thank you both.
Always fun, Robert. Thanks.
John Diamond, National Security Correspondent for USA Today, and Ken Allard, former Army Colonel and Adjunct Professor at Georgetown University. The U.S. dollar today is trading at $1.32 against the euro in Europe, the latest tick in a long slide that sapped the dollar of almost half its value in the last 3 years. In a moment, we're going to find out what that might mean to the American economy and to the world. But first, what does it mean to Americans living abroad? Here and Now correspondent Michael Goldfarb is in London. Welcome, Michael.
Hello, Robin.
Michael, you're based overseas, working for an American company, our home station, WBUR. So what's it been like to be an American on American dollars in London?
It's been one of the more painful experiences of my adult life. The dollar has lost 15% of its value in the last year, although I confess it feels like it's lost a lot more just in terms of my purchasing power. It's an incredibly difficult situation for Americans who are based here working for American companies.
I'm looking at a comparison chart in USA Today recently. For instance, 5 nights in a 4-star hotel in New York, $362. In Britain, $962. A guest jacket in the U.S., $97. In Britain, $195.
Yeah, this may explain why yesterday as I was walking around London's West End, that's kind of downtown London, the heart of the city. I walked from Soho, which is kind of the bohemian neighborhood, through Chinatown, through Leicester Square, which is the heart of the theater district, and heard almost no American accents at all. Now, you know, this time of year in December, we don't have a lot of tourists. I mean, the weather is pretty poor. But, you know, even the kind of people who are always there, there's always a lot of military families. Interestingly enough, Robin, there are still a fair number of American soldiers based here in Britain. They're based over on the continent. And people will frequently come to London. They'll bring the family, you know, for a 4 or 5 day long weekend. No one. Now, presumably some of those guys are in Iraq, but nevertheless, the expense of going off base for an American soldier or his family who's living with him in Europe is now prohibitive.
Yeah, we understand that they're staying on their PXs where they can buy duty-free. Well, but what do you hear about your British friends? Are they all flocking to the States?
I hate them. I hate them. No, what's happening is this: when you get into these situations, and let's be clear, we have been here before, and it goes the other way. In 1984, when I was planning my move to Britain, it was $1.03 to the pound. So it does go the other way. But about 10 years ago, we were in this position. And it's great for my British friends, because what they do is they simply get a cheap flight to New York and a long weekend in New York shopping. And I don't mean shopping for fun, but shopping for everything more than pays for itself. You know, if you go and you need to buy a suit, well, a man's suit here, a decent man's suit might be £600 or £700. And in New York, it'll be $600 or $700. It's half price.
Right. So you cover your airfare and your hotel if you buy several items.
Exactly.
We hear, too, that, for instance, in other parts of Europe, it's cheaper to go from Brussels to Utah to ski than it is to go over to Switzerland.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, this current situation will bring certain kinds of money into the U.S., and it's clear that this is one of the reasons why the Bush administration's economic honchos are willing to let the dollar slide. It will do a tremendous amount of good for retailers, probably on the East Coast. It will bring a certain amount of pressure to the Florida real estate market, as if it wasn't already hot enough, because Florida is actually a very popular destination for Brits.
But tell me this, Michael, how are British and other European officials feeling long-term about the down dollar?
They're very concerned, because, I mean, the United States is an important market. It's virtually impossible to export when, you know, the prices in dollars are so prohibitive. The other side of it is that, you know, companies with a predatory instinct interested in conglomerating, as they did in the 80s, will find a lot of bargains, and they will come into the United States and begin to buy up companies. And in fact, that did happen the last time the pound was this strong. Several entrepreneurs, you know, came over and they started buying up American companies. It cuts across a lot of different ways.
Here now is Michael Goldfarb speaking to us from London, where his dollar isn't going as far as it once did. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Big sigh. Well, you stay right there, because just ahead, we're going to ask an economist what the falling dollar means for the U.S. economy. Now, he's one of the few who says, except if, like Michael, you live overseas, doesn't mean much. And later in the program, nonprofit hospitals suing poor patients. Is the charitable care system sick? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our look at the falling dollar, many analysts are worried about what it means for the U.S. economy. Mike Mandel is not. He's chief economist for Businessweek magazine, author of the book The Rational Exuberance. And Mike, give us a quick primer first. Why does a dollar go down?
Well, what a lot of people say these days is that the reason why the dollar is going down is because the U.S. is consuming. We're importing more than we export, and therefore the dollar has to go down to adjust.
Yeah, and why?
Well, if you're importing more than you're exporting, what it means is that you are sending lots of dollars out into the world to buy these goods that you're buying. There's more dollars out there. The supply of dollars has increased, and therefore the price of dollars will go down.
Right. Like anything else, if there's so much of it, it's not as valuable.
Exactly. And the other thing is that in order to adjust the trade deficit, that is, in order to have us import less, the dollar has to go down, which makes the cost of what we buy from overseas go up. And that's what serves as the adjustment mechanism.
Well, but wait, if so many foreign tourists are coming to this country to buy things, doesn't that ease the trade deficit?
That eases the trade deficit a bit. And that's part of the adjustment mechanism, which is that not only do imports become more expensive, but U.S. goods and services become cheaper for foreigners. So that's why the tourists come here.
Well, now let's look at some other ways that a falling dollar affects us. What about investments? Because there is this weak dollar, more U.S. investors are investing abroad. Why?
Well, what's happened is that people are worried right now that if the dollar falls, that their investments in the U.S. will become worth less. Conversely, if you're investing in Europe and the euro goes up, then your investments there are going to be worth more. The flip side of this, of course, is that U.S. assets are cheaper, so that it could very well be that foreigners want to, say, buy up U.S. companies or U.S. real estate. So there's really a flow of money going both ways.
But doesn't it illustrate something else? You say it's because Americans are spending so much money and thereby, you know, sending their money abroad. Doesn't that mean that we're not saving?
There's two points of view here. One point of view, which is a very moralistic point of view, says that Americans are living beyond their means. We're not saving enough. And that's why we are running these deficits. That's why the dollar is going down. And this just shows how basically desolate we are. My point of view is that the U.S. economy is actually doing quite well. We're attracting a lot of foreign investors coming in to invest in the economy, and this is basically a positive. So I don't actually see this as a big deal.
You don't really see this as big an issue as, let's say, Paul Krugman, who's been writing that, well, you're laughing, but he and others are writing that the U.S. Is possibly poised to be like Argentina, collapsing under its own weight.
There's a lot of people like Krugman who are, and let me just make sure, this is not liberal versus conservative. There's people like Krugman who's a liberal. There's people like Greg Mankiw, who's the head of the Council of Economic Advisers, who's a conservative, who are obsessed about U.S. savings. And they basically ignore things like innovation.
But at a time of a huge deficit, can Americans afford to be in personal debt or to pull investments from the U.S., put them abroad, leading to the need for more foreign capital to finance an even bigger deficit?
It is still true that people get higher rates of return in the U.S. than they get elsewhere. And the reason is for that is because the U.S. is growing much faster than Europe is. The U.S. is still attracting, based on the latest statistics, an enormous amount of foreign money. Frankly, what's happening here is that people are taking the advice of their financial advisors and they're saying, well, put a little bit more money out into foreign stocks and bonds. The real issue actually that's going on in the larger sense has not to do with Europe, it has to do with China. Because what China is doing is keeping their currency, the yuan, completely level with the dollar.
Which is one of the reasons Europeans are so angry. China props up its currency, so the U.S. buys China's cheaper products instead of Europe's. European leaders are critical of Americans who go into debt, but they're also crying foul on trade, which is a little confusing because their tourists are benefiting so from traveling here.
What's going on now is that the Europeans are quite confused. On the one hand, they want to blame the U.S. for running big deficits. On the other hand, they don't like when the dollar falls against the euro because what it means is that their currency, the euro, gets stronger and they have more trouble exporting stuff. The problem that the Europeans have is that they have no growth in domestic demand. They depend on exports to the U.S. too. So despite the fact that they beat up on us for running a deficit, the only thing that's really keeping Europe afloat right now is, in fact, the fact that the U.S. consumers and U.S. businesses are willing to keep buying European goods.
Well, President Bush also said this week that the White House would shore up the dollar by trying to fix the deficit, the trade deficit and fix Social Security. But some have said that the Bush administration maybe really doesn't want to raise the dollar because, as we've been saying, it's bringing so many foreign buyers into the country.
I think what the Bush administration wants is for the dollar maybe to fall a little bit more and then sort of even out. And I think that movements of the dollar, as long as they're not terribly abrupt, are really not a big deal for the economy. What's really much more important, frankly, is growth rates, what's happening to wages, what's happening to jobs. That's really what goes more into in people's well-being.
Yeah, and by the way, what should people do in the short term? What should the average consumer, the average citizen, not the big foreign investor, what should someone do?
In terms of the dollar, not worry very much. This is what I often find at Business Week is that people will propose, the dollar is moving. They'll propose to do a story about the dollar, and it'll turn out to come out rather flat because at the end, the movements of the dollar, if you're not a currency trader, the movements of the dollar are not all that important. But in at base, what really makes people well off or badly off is, do they have a job?
And how many dollars they're being paid.
And how many dollars they're being paid.
Well, Mike Mandel, many people hope you're right. Thank you very much.
I'm very glad to be here.
Mike Mandel, chief economist with Business Week, author of the book The Rational Exuberance. And next week, from the incredibly shrinking dollar to ever-expanding museums. Next week on Here and Now, museums across the country. Some are adding new wings with the help of blockbuster exhibits. One's making a major move. What does all this mean for America's cultural legacy? Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hospitals slapping poor patients with thousands of dollars in medical charges, suing them when they can't pay, authorizing the police to haul unresponsive, possibly ill debtors into court. Modern-day Dickens, and according to reporter Jonathan Cohn, it's happening across the country, and the hospitals involved are nonprofits set up to help the poor and receiving millions of dollars in tax breaks. In this Sunday's New York Times Magazine, Jonathan Cohn asks, how did an arrangement to treat the needy become so unhealthy? And he finds more than one answer. Jonathan joins us on the line. Welcome.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Well, first of all, to get a sense of how deep this problem is, your article is full of heartrending anecdotes about working people, a Walmart employee, for instance, who can't pay their medical bills, but who are being hounded by collection agencies. Can you just give us a snapshot of one of these people?
Well, sure. The woman from Walmart you talked about, her name is Maggie Longcar, Margaret Longcar. She lives in Chicago. She and her husband had run up, I think, about $40,000 in medical bills over a series of visits. She had no way to pay for them. She did not have health insurance, and she acquired health insurance fairly late in the game, but her husband had no health insurance.
And she couldn't afford to cover him on her policy.
She could not afford to cover him on her salary. And this is very common among the uninsured. If you talk to people without health insurance, it's often the case that they have some kind of coverage that is available to them, but there's no realistic way that they can pay for it. They had hoped the hospital would help them. They say the hospital did not offer any assistance. The only suggestion was they try to go through the state Medicaid system, which wasn't very helpful.
And this is a nonprofit charitable hospital, by the way, right?
Yes, it is. She described to me that the sort of mounting bills and her concern over it had really worried them a lot. And she says that one day he was very sick, and she thought maybe he needed to go to the emergency room, and he said no. And she suspected he simply was afraid to get more bills, and she figured she'd let it go, and she came home that night, and she found him dead in their home.
Well, in this case, as you say, the hospital claims that they told the patients to file for Medicaid. What overall are the hospitals saying to these accusations that they're not giving the poor a break?
They claim, first of all, they sort of have two answers. The first answer is that they say if you dig deep enough in these stories, you'll find that patients themselves often were not so responsible. They refused to fill out paperwork. They didn't comply with instructions, or they wouldn't even answer bills. So that basically the bills would come to the house, the patients would ignore them, and after a year or so, the hospital would say, well, you know, what are we going to do? We're going to have to send this out to a collection agency. The other answer the hospitals would make, and this is sort of a broader answer about the way hospitals work, is that they are under an incredible amount of financial pressure right now. The number of people without health insurance is going up. And at some point, this ceases to be the responsibility of individual hospitals, even given their tax breaks, and someone else has to step in and do something about the insurance system.
Well, in fact, do us a favor and very briefly take us through the chronology of these nonprofit hospitals. They were set up at the turn of the century to treat the poor. Over the course of the century, how did the way they get their own funds change?
Well, in effect, over the 20th century, the way the system for paying for medical care in this country worked was there was sort of this unwritten arrangement where private insurance companies and government insurers basically paid hospitals a little more than it actually cost to treat patients. It wasn't intentional, it just sort of worked out that way. But this money was useful in the sense that the nonprofit hospitals, or for-profit hospitals for that matter, because for-profit hospitals would also see uninsured patients, they could take some of the extra money they were making on the paying patients and essentially use it to cover the cost of treating people who weren't paying. It's called cost shifting. But what's happened recently in the last, 20, 30 years, the government has sort of seen some of the programs that they have as wasteful, so they've cut down on their reimbursement to the hospitals. And, of course, and everyone with private insurance knows that everything has moved to managed care now, and managed care pays a lot less to the hospitals than the old insurance did. So as a result, all that extra money that was sloshing around in the system isn't really there anymore. And the hospitals say that because of that, they have a lot less money to cover the cost of the uninsured, and so they are having to be, I guess, a little more disciplined about how they spend their money.
Well, but hospitals tell you that they do give a lot of uncompensated care. But is that the same thing as charitable care, or what's the difference?
Well, that is a very big debate about that. The hospital, a lot of the accusations being thrown at the hospitals focus on, hospitals have to file official statistics with the state of the amount of charity care they give. And charity care is when you say to a patient, don't even worry about this bill, we're just going to write it off. Now, the hospitals say that's a little unfair because there's another measure you can use, which is called uncompensated care, which is much, much larger. And but uncompensated care basically refers to any bill they send out that doesn't get collected. And the difference is someone who has who's been given charity care will get the treatment, and then will be told, don't worry about it, you don't have to pay this bill. Somebody who ends up in the uncompensated care category quite possibly got the medical care, got a bill, was then pursued for collection by a collection agency, maybe was sued, as this woman was from Walmart. And at the end of the day, they didn't get much money from it, so they kind of write it off as, well, this was uncompensated care.
Mm. You have a great quote from a doctor in your article. He says, I'd like to see somebody buy a car and not get a bill. Why don't hotels in this country give rooms to the homeless? But the response, of course, is that these hospitals are set up to treat the poor, and that's why they get huge tax breaks. They are being sued, as you write, by state officials and patient advocates. They're getting some of these tax breaks revoked, but that also in the long run doesn't help the poor. So what conclusion do you come to? How is the system going to change?
Well, I mean, I think ultimately, and I should just mention that the hospitals will tell you that it's not exclusively for serving the poor they get these tax breaks. The tax breaks are for the benefits they provide to the community broadly, and there's lots of different benefits they provide. But everybody, I think, seems to agree pretty much that serving the poor is a component of that, and many of them say so in their charters. But overall, I think this is a bad system. I mean, I think asking these hospitals, in the end, we have a problem where we have this huge millions, 45 million people in this country don't have health insurance, and we have this backward system where we depend on hospitals to be charitable and then simultaneously ask them to put up with less money and be more competitive and act in a more business-like manner. I think ultimately the solution is something that Americans are never seemed ready to do before, but I think we need to have some kind of universal health care system where everybody has health insurance, and then, frankly, you'll be rid of this whole problem.
Until then, what?
Well, state governments are looking at whether to revoke some of the tax exemptions these hospitals have. I don't think they really want to do that. I think they'd rather use that as a threat to get the hospitals to be a little more generous with the charity care. Some local governments are considering passing laws imposing stricter requirements on how hospitals treat the uninsured. So I think that's one way. I think you see hospitals already, many hospitals in response to these lawsuits that are going on, changing their policies on their own.
At the end of your article, there's not as clear-cut a villain as it would seem to be at the beginning.
Well, you know, I'll leave readers to judge that. I spent several months working on this story, and I found a lot of sympathetic people. And I think it's hard to be certain whether, you know, both in individual cases and broader, to what extent you can blame the hospitals, to what extent you can blame the patients. I would say the one thing I am absolutely 100% certain of is that you can blame the system. This is a terrible system for delivering health care. This is a terrible insurance system. And until we fix this insurance system, we're just going to have more problems like this throughout the healthcare system.
Jonathan Cohn's article, Uncharitable, appears in this Sunday's issue of the New York Times Magazine. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, theater critic Bill Marks with gift ideas for the theater lovers in your life. You're listening to Here and Now. Food is always a big part of the holidays, but one traditional food has, for the most part, disappeared from American tables. Reporter Lester Graham has the story.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
You've probably heard that old song, romanticized roasting chestnuts as part of the holidays for years. But a lot of us have never even seen chestnuts, let alone roasted them on an open fire. Chestnuts used to be a major part of the eastern hardwood forest. There were millions of them. In fact, 25% of all the mature trees were chestnuts. But a blight imported with some Chinese chestnut trees slowly wiped out the American chestnut trees. Well, almost. Much of the rootstock is still alive. Sprouts grow until the blight knocks them back again. A blight only hurts the standing tree where it branches out. And in a few isolated pockets in the Midwest, the blight hasn't reached the trees. A few American chestnuts are alive and growing, and some of them are free of blight. At Nash Nurseries in central Michigan, owner Bill Nash is guiding us through a rare sight, a grove of American chestnuts.
These are 20 years old, and as you can see, they're fairly good size. The American chestnut is quite a rapid-growing tree. It's well-suited for our climate, so it doesn't have any of the problems that some of the hybrids do as far as growing and cultural care. You have to take care of them. The Americans, you get them started, and they're pretty much on their own.
In a few places in Michigan and Wisconsin, there are small groves of chestnuts. They're prized trees. They're great for shade. The hardwood is rot-resistant and makes great furniture and fence posts. And the chestnuts are eaten by humans and wildlife alike. Bill Nash says the tree will be popular again if it ever overcomes the blight that's hit it so hard.
The American chestnut will make another big comeback in this country as a yard tree, as a timber tree, as a wildlife tree.
That part about a wildlife tree is a lot more important than just worrying about squirrels and bunnies. Chestnuts were an important food source for all kinds of animals. Andrew Jarris is a plant biologist at Michigan State University. He says the loss of the chestnuts has been hard on wildlife populations.
Chestnuts shed nuts in a more regular pattern than oaks, which have what are called mashed years, where they'll have like major crops, massive crops one year and very small crops in other years, which means that it's either feast or famine if you're depending on oaks.
Since the blight first began hitting American chestnuts about a century ago, researchers have been looking into all kinds of ways to stop it. One way is to cross it with the Chinese chestnut, which has a couple of genes that resist the blight. But it takes a long time to breed out the Chinese characteristics from the American chestnuts and still keep the resistant genes. Another approach is genetic manipulation, genetically modifying the American chestnut tree to make it disease resistant. Again, work is underway, but it takes a long time. And even after success, it's likely some people won't like the idea of releasing a genetically modified organism into the wild. The final approach worked in Europe when the blight hit there. It seems there's a naturally occurring virus that kills the blight. It spread naturally in Europe. There are a few groves in Michigan that have naturally acquired the virus, and it's working to keep the blight at bay. Andrew Jerez is working on the research. He says the trick is figuring out how to get the virus to spread to other trees, short of manually spreading it on cankers infected by the blight.
If we're literally talking about millions of trees across probably, you know, the eastern third of the country, we obviously can't treat every canker on every tree, and we need to be able to figure out a way to deploy the virus in a way that it, you know, it can spread.
Even with all that hopeful research, it'll be 10 years at least before some practical solutions end up in the forests. And Jerris believes a couple of centuries before the American chestnut holds the place it once did in the forest. Bill Nash knows it'll be a while before there are major changes, but he's optimistic about the American chestnut.
Oh, I would think the tree has a bright future. There's enough people working on that, enough programs going on now. And so I would suspect that in not too distant future, we should have some of this progress made. You know, Robert Frost in his poem predicted the comeback of the American chestnut.
Frost put it this way: will the blight end the chestnut? The farmers rather guess not. It keeps smoldering at the roots and sending up new shoots, till another parasite shall come to end the blight. Seems Frost was an optimist, too.
That report from Lester Graham of the Great Lakes Radio Consortium. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
No use permitting some prophet of doom to wipe every smile away. Life is a cabaret, oh, come to the cabaret.
The title track from the original Broadway musical Cabaret by the songwriting team Kander and Ebb. Fred Ebb passed away in September. His spirit and the spirit of cabaret life in general live on in the new book, The Cabaret. It comes highly recommended by Here and Now's theater critic Bill Marks, who joins us now to talk about gift ideas for the theater lover in your life or in you. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Robin.
And looking at this book, it's beautiful. I just described the cover. The cover alone reflects a view of cabaret. It's a painting of, you know, big bare-breasted, feather-boaed showgirls, sort of, you know, early German expressionism. I read that it's actually a detail of a 1903 magazine mm-hmm. cover. You know, pinched faces, thin penciled-in eyebrows. But they're walking obliviously past what appears to be a beggar with no legs. They're grotesque at the same time.
Obviously, that was chosen as an illustration for the cover of the book to illustrate the theme of the book. When we think about cabaret, we think of just sort of, you know, you're in a smoky bar, you're listening to a chanteuse singing, you know, a hit song. While the thesis of this book is that, you know, cabaret was born with modernism in the turn of the century. Thus, it was breaking conventional forms, and it was also extremely political.
The Cabaret was written by Lisa Apagnanisi, I hope I've got that right, originally in 1975. This is an expanded version.
This is an expanded version, and often when authors go back and revisit books, they're often not an improvement. I mean, they add new material, but it doesn't really make it all that much better. But this really is an improvement, particularly because now that after the Iron Curtain fell in 1989, she got a lot of stuff about cabaret in Russia, which he's now been able to add into this book and also other parts behind the Iron Curtain. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of really great illustrations as well that has been added to it.
Okay. Again, The Cabaret by Lisa Apinanisi, recommended by Bill Marks. You have two other books, though, that also struck your fancy.
Right. And these are both extraordinary volumes of letters, both by major figures in the theater of the 20th century. The most chatty, the most gossipy, the most fun is the letters of John Gielgud, an actor whose life, active career, spanned the century. He knew everyone. You name it, you know, Olivier, Vivian Leigh, Ralph Richardson, Edward Albee. I mean, he was a number of Albee's plays. I mean, you know, everybody. And he wrote to all of them, and they wrote back to him.
Thankfully, he wrote letters.
And he was also known for, you know, his sort of magnificent slips of the tongue, you know, both in productions. I mean, he'd often say just the wrong thing at the wrong time, you know, sort of to deflate a director or to make another actor feel bad. He was sort of known for his honesty, which was a little too bald and a little too brazen, a little too naive, but still was delicious. And some of these slips can be found in these letters.
You got a couple of lines there for us?
I'll just give you a quick line here. And this is just where he's writing about someone, an actor that actually he takes a lot of bites out of throughout the collection, and that's Alec Guinness. I think he felt a certain sense of competition with him. So he's talking about being in Boston, and this is on August 4th. And the year is 1959. Lovely weather here and a very nice suite looking onto the park. Slept till 12 yesterday and trotted out to see The Scapegoat, which was simply dreadful. Alec Guinness, just the same bad in both his dual roles and everyone else acting their heads off. You'll have to see it for Irene Wirth as the wicked wife and Pamela Brown and Betty Davis giving her all. They're not major letters to the extent that I don't think Gielgud was what you would call an intellectual. There's not a lot of theoretical talk about the theater. You don't really get a lot of insight into his technique as an actor. But if you want to get an idea of what it's like of a wonderful actor with an engaged mind who knew everybody and exchanged opinions with them, this is the book for you.
Excellent. And you have another one there as well.
Yeah. Now, this book, I think, is even more substantial. This is the second volume of The Selected Letters of Tennessee Williams. This is volume two, so it stretches from 1945 to 1957, encompassing Streetcar Named Desire, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. I mean, some of the really major Williams plays. Now, what's great about these is that unlike Gielgud, there's lots of gossip about sort of the gay lifestyle of the period of the 50s. I mean, he writes to Gore Vidal, who is a very good friend, and they're always comparing notes on boyfriends and what's going on the beaches. But what's great about this is that it also indicates that the intellectual side of Williams, the passionate side of Williams, and the voice of Williams. In a sense, you really feel that you get a sense of what it was like to sit in a room with this terribly romantic, vivacious, caring man.
Give us an example.
Well, I'm going to read this. This gives you an idea a little bit about if someone was directing Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, this might give them some advice. It also gives you an idea of a little bit of how serious and passionate, you know, Williams was as a playwright. And he's writing to Ella Kazan, who was the director who premiered Cat on a Hot Tin Roof on Broadway. And this is in 1954. I am glad that in Cat we are getting off the chest some of the terrible things that we have to say about human fate. I want to keep the core of the play very hard, because I detest plays that are built around something mushy, such as I feel under the surface of many sentimental successes in the theater. I want the core of the play to be as hard and fierce as Big Daddy. I think he strikes a keynote of the play. A terrible black anger and ferocity, a rock-bottom honesty. Only against this background can his moments of tenderness, of longing, move us deeply. This is a play about good bastards and good bitches. I love that last line.
And you're quoting Tennessee Williams.
Yes,
for those
that's
who just
Tennessee Williams about his
paying attention
about his play. This is,
that sounds great.
Anyone who loves, if you love Tennessee Williams, if you love American theater, and if you love good writing, because I really think that, frankly, these letters I think are greater than a lot of the some of the plays that are being produced today. They're that well written and that engaging.
Okay, that's The Selected Letters of Tennessee Williams, edited by Albert Devlin. Now, I know before you go, we want to get a few suggestions for DVDs you recommend.
All right, here are a few DVDs. They're not all going to be theater-related. I mean, the first one is Angels in America, which is the current production that won the slew of awards with Meryl Streep, directed by Mike Nichols. That is now available on DVD with lots of extras, and it was a wonderful production. And obviously the DVD for anyone who really cares about that play or loves theater will want to have that.
That's the HBO production of Tony Kushner's masterpiece.
Right.
And?
And the Marx Brothers. Yes, they have my name. No, I would love them anyway. I'm not related to them. The DVD set includes all their Paramount movies, which is all the early stuff, like Coconuts, Animal Crackers, and then you get to their masterpiece, Duck Soup. The other one is a silent film DVD set, which will bring tears to the eyes of anyone who really loves great comedy and genius. And that is Buster Keaton, his years at MGM. Buster Keaton created some masterpieces in the silent era, including The General. Then he went to MGM, and that was a move up in the late 20s. But MGM was sort of a factory, and he was an idiosyncratic genius. And they basically wore him down, took away all of his comedy team, and essentially destroyed him. I mean, he became an alcoholic, and after about maybe 5 years, his career was washed up. There's a wonderful documentary which tells you about what happened to Buster, as well as two of the MGM films, The Cameraman and Spike Marriage, which also has some moments of genius. It's a wonderful set because it does give people some insight to what he did in MGM, but also it's sort of an interesting warning tale of what happens to true. You know, it's sort of like if Picasso joined an art institute and was washing up the bathrooms at the after 5 years, and that's what they did to Buster Keaton. I think people should see it.
Well, and on that recommendation, many will. Here and Now theater critic Bill Marks. For a complete list of his gift ideas, check out our website at here-now.org. Bill, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. And for our Chestnut on Chestnuts, our thanks today go to the Great Lakes Radio Consortium, a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation and the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Cooperative Extension Service. You can learn more about Great Lakes Radio Consortium stories at glrc.org. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.